Hello, everybody. This is Angela Glosser, your Good News On Demand volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Today, I'm going to read a few articles. The first one is from the New York Times. It's called, His Novel Sold a Million Copies. James McBride Isn't Sure How He Feels About That, by Elizabeth A. Harris. And it was published on March 24, 2024, in the New York Times. The second article is also from the New York Times, and it's by Kate Zernike. It is called, A Utah Mountain Town Brings Back an Old Idea, The One-Room Schoolhouse, and it was published on April 21, 2024. And the third article is from The Atlantic. It's called, A Secret Code May Have Been Hiding in Classical Music for 200 Years, by S.I. Rosenbaum, and it was published on April 4th, 2024. His novel sold a million copies. James McBride isn't sure how he feels about that. The Heaven and Earth grocery store has been a runaway critical and commercial success. When you've been David all your life, everything changes when you become Goliath. When people ask the author, James McBride, what he does for work, he tells them he's a saxophone player. In a sense, that is true enough. He runs a small music program at a church in Brooklyn and spends much of his time playing the tenor and soprano sax in the basement of his New Jersey home, which he soundproofed so the noise doesn't bother his neighbors. But McBride, 66, makes his living as an author, and right now that living is very good. His latest novel, The Heaven and Earth Grocery Store, which follows the Black and Jewish residents of a Pennsylvania town in the early 20th century, hit a milestone. Since its release last summer, it has sold more than a million copies. Most authors are lucky to sell 10,000 books. McBride, who has written 8 books, has found success before. His novel, The Good Lord Bird, won the National Book Award. Deacon King Kong was an Oprah Book Club pick and a New York Times bestseller. His debut, The Color of Water, a memoir about his white Jewish mother, Ruth, got off to a slow start, but began by spreading the word of mouth once it was out on paperback. Eventually, it sold more than 2 million copies. But sales as fast and robust as McBride is seeing now are vanishingly rare, especially in the world of literary fiction. And while he is certainly grateful for his success, McBride does not seem all that comfortable with it. You've been David all your life, and you become Goliath, he said, sitting at a worn wooden table in his kitchen. Your life changes when you become Goliath. McBride grew up in Brooklyn and Queens with 11 siblings, on precarious financial footing, just short of welfare, he said. His mother, Ruth McBride Jordan, raised her children, taking advantage of free cultural events in New York City and free lunches at school. As adults, her children became, among other things, doctors, professors, and teachers. His mother, an Orthodox Jew, was born in Poland as Rukel Dwarjua Zieliska and raised in Virginia. At 17, she left home and found her way to Harlem, where she converted to Christianity and married a Black minister, Andrew D. McBride. His parents founded the New Brown Memorial Baptist Church in their living room on Hicks Street, McBride said. He still teaches English as a second language there every Saturday and runs the music program. McBride's father died while his mother was pregnant with him. My first book was about me, unfortunately, he said. Because of The Color of Water, I became the Black Jewish guy. And what do I know about that? I can't even balance my checkbook. Since then, his books have been all about other people, mostly imagined. McBride learned to be a novelist, he said, by being a reporter. After graduating from Oberlin College, where he threw himself into playing jazz, he worked as a journalist at newspapers, including the Boston Globe and Washington Post. You learn to walk into a room and smell the room, eat the food, count the room, he said. You just draw the story out of the room. That's what journalism teaches you. That reporter's instinct has stayed with him. McBride spent months in the South doing research for The Good Lord Bird and went on several trips to Pottstown, Pennsylvania, so he could write The Heaven and Earth Grocery Store. The greatest thing about him is his interactions with people on the street, said Patrick Stravelek, a sculptor and friend of McBride's. He'll talk to everyone and pull information from them somehow. McBride has been a working author for about 30 years, but the success of the Heaven and Earth Grocery Store has been extraordinary. Kristen McLean, the executive director for Circana Books and Entertainment, said sales of this magnitude generally come from memoirs by exceptionally high-profile authors or the release of a new book in a popular series. The Heaven and Earth Grocery Store, by contrast, found its success in large part through support from bookstores, McLean said. The novel was chosen as the best book of 2023 by both Barnes & Noble and Amazon, and was supported by independent stores as well. And then there's the strength of the novel itself, which is a story of justice, love, and community that has resonated with readers, she said. There are writers who are interested in story, writers who are interested in character, writers who are interested in place, and writers who are interested in voice, said Jake Morrissey, McBride's editor, and an executive editor at Riverhead. He manages, either by intention or by some other alchemy, to be able to hold all four of those strains in his hands at once. Despite his accomplishments, McBride's tastes remain sensible and pragmatic. He lives in a small city in central New Jersey in a brick house that used to be a grocery store. He likes cars, but he doesn't buy fancy ones. His current ride is a white Chevy Bolt. He has an apartment in Brooklyn, so he has a place to stay while teaching at New York University, where he is a writer in residence. But his apartment building is a simple brick co-op without fancy amenities. Even his garden skews toward common sense. McBride said he likes to grow broccoli, tomatoes, kale, and potatoes, but not flowers, all the practical stuff, he said. His home in New Jersey is packed with instruments. A grand piano dominates the living room, and a drum set and an electric bass guitar keep the saxophones company in the basement. But aside from the music, his house is mostly quiet, and he said he misses the busy family life he grew up with. His children are grown, and he is divorced. His partner lives elsewhere in New Jersey. There are stacks of books and papers on his scuffed wooden desk beside a typewriter with green keys that he'll sometimes use when feeling stuck. McBride says he reads mostly nonfiction, though recently he has been into John le Carré. He likes Le Carré's voice and his narrative power, McBride said, but he has also read his memoir and a biography because he was curious about the man. Here was a guy who was really successful, super successful, far more successful than I am, McBride said. I just wanted to see if he was happy, you know? McBride is grateful, if still a little surprised, with the freedom success affords him. He said he was somewhat baffled that he could afford to soundproof his basement so he could play his saxophone more freely. But he is, all the same, suspicious of the distraction that public literary fame can become. I've always steered clear of the hubbub of the business, McBride said, because it doesn't help me do my job. And that, he said, is to listen to people. Now I'll read the second article. A Utah mountain town brings back an old idea, the one-room schoolhouse. As a throwback ski destination, Alta thinks small, with a one-room public school to match. As long as it has had a ski resort, Alta, Utah has been a place where young people come to work for a season before starting life in the real world, then end up staying for 2 or 10 or 20 years, even a lifetime. They come for the powder snow, which regularly tops lists of the deepest and lightest in the country. They discover the simplicity and warmth of life in a town at the dead end of a box canyon with a year-round population of roughly 300. But a little more than 20 years ago, town officials realized that as much as Alta prided itself on being a place where generations of families returned to vacation every year, it was losing families among the employees who make it run. Young people who had children left because there was no school, and the closest school district would not send a bus up the narrow canyon road. Known as a throwback ski town, Alta turned to a throwback solution, opening a one-room public school in a former storage room in a lodge at the base of the mountain. Now, the Alta School not only educates the children of the ticket sellers, avalanche forecasters, hotel reservationists, and chai latte makers, it's also a source of town pride. The annual play, written and performed by students at Our Lady of Snows, the town's worship and gathering center, attracts a standing room only crowd, more than can be explained as proud parents alone. Students publish a monthly newspaper visiting the lodges and ski slopes to sell ads they design. It might be an overstatement, Roger Bourque, the mayor of Alta, said, but it ties the community together. Less than a century ago, there were about 139,000 one-room public schools in the United States. At last official count, in 2022, there were 166, mostly in rural areas where the nearest district is too far for students to travel each day. In Alta, the closest school is just 13 miles away, in a suburb of Salt Lake City. But the winding road up Little Cottonwood Canyon closes frequently because of avalanche danger, more than 30 times last year, when Alta had 903 inches of snow. Beyond eliminating the treacherous commute, the school helps in the ongoing struggle to, as Mr. Bourque said, keep Alta, Alta. While other ski resorts have been brought up by conglomerates and developed with condos, Alta, founded in 1938, is still owned by the same families that have owned it for generations, and hardly more developed than in its earliest days as a silver mining town. There is no light nightlife, no stoplight, and no snowboarders allowed. Alta, as the t-shirts say, is for skiers. The town, just 4 square miles, centers on the resort and occupies mostly National Forest Service property. It has fought attempts to develop what private land there is. Signs up the canyon and stickers on skis declare opposition to a gondola the State Department of Transportation has proposed building to ferry bigger crowds up the canyon. It's a different pace of life in today's hustle and bustle, said Brian Babbitt, a ski patroller, picking up his daughters Miles and Collins after school. They can focus on different qualities of life, recreating and being in nature, not being so stuck on a screen or a computer. The girls are 6 and 8 now. They've been skiing on their own since they were 3 and 5, though my wife would say it's 4 and 6, Mr. Babbitt said. I know 100 people by first name on the mountain, so they're constantly being watched. Really? Miles asked. Most skiers visiting Alta would have no idea the school exists, though they might wonder at the pint-sized skiers expertly bouncing along the mountain's famously long traverses. That's PE class. The cars full of skiers have not begun to fill the parking lot as the 14 students start their day. With the sun just hitting Mount Baldy far above them, they begin with an observation walk alongside the rope tow that stretches from one end of the resort to the other. Their teacher, J.N. Shifley, slipping in small lessons about the science of weather. Then, in through a side door at the gold miner's daughter lodge, they sharpen pencils for their daily time math quiz, which gives Ms. Sheffley time to take attendance. Except that the windows are almost entirely buried under snow, the school looks like a typical classroom. But having to teach students at 9 grade levels keeps Ms. Sheffley in constant steady motion, even more than most teachers. During math, she moves between an 8th grader working on quadratic equations and a kindergartner learning to regroup as she adds. During science, she stands over the desks of 2 6th graders using a hand warmer and an aluminum can to demonstrate heat transfer. At a desk behind her, a 4th grader is using a thesaurus, a knitting skein, and a ruler to build a tape dispenser, a lesson on Rube Goldberg machines. The students come together for art, watching a short video about an artist who used quilts to tell stories, then split up to make paper quilts of their own. Many tell of mountain adventures and mishaps. Collins, in 2nd grade, cuts shapes of soft pink and black to represent her leg and the brace she wore after she tore her ACL. This leads to a bit of site-specific classroom one-upmanship. "My mom tore her ACL," one student calls over. Another replies, "My mom tore her ACL twice and her meniscus." Miss Sheffley, whose father and grandmother both taught in one-room schoolhouses, led the school at Alta for 9 years, then left for 9, teaching in schools abroad. She came back 3 years ago when the teacher who had taken her place left to raise her children. She had missed having the same students year after year and the ability to individualize teaching. "I always thought of this school as the place where I really learned how kids learn, how they progress," she said. "We say that they have to read at 5, do this when they're 6, and do that when they're 7. But all of my understanding of kids is that that doesn't make sense. Development is a continuum." With a small, ungraded school, Ms. Sheffley said, "We could put everywhere where they were. They caught up when they caught up." Jen Life, who came to Alta as a housekeeper and ended up as co-owner of the Gold Miner's Daughter's Lodge, made room in the storage area for the school and later had 2 children and sent them there. "There are always naysayers who say it's too small. How will they adjust?" she said. "But they've all done well. They've learned to work independently and be self-sufficient because the teacher was busy teaching different grades." Like the town, the school feels like a family. Parents help lead the PE classes up the mountain. The resort provides reduced-price lift tickets, and the students spend most weekends skiing together, too. The number of students will drop by a few before the end of the school year as the ski season ends. Alta's official last day is April 21, and some parents head off to other seasonal jobs as far away as Thailand. Marley Corpella, who runs reservations at the Alta Lodge, said her son, Tade, sometimes wishes there was more than just one other 4th grader. But when he thinks about going to school in the valley, he thinks what most people do when they think of Alta, the skiing. He says, "Then I'd have to pay for the full ticket." Now I will read the 3rd article. A secret code may have been hiding in classical music for 200 years. A violinist believes he has discovered a previously unknown system of dynamics in Beethoven's original manuscripts by S.I. Rosenbaum. In the spring of 1825, Ludwig von Beethoven was struck by a gut ailment so severe that he thought he might die. That summer, after he recovered, he returned to the string quartet he'd been writing before his illness, Quartet No. 15 in A minor, Opus 132, and added a new segment inspired by his survival. To this day, the piece is known for the slowly unfolding, baffled joy of its 3rd movement, where the music seems to trace the shuffling steps of an invalid breathing fresh air for the first time in weeks. Beethoven would call it Heiliger Danzigdan, a holy song of thanksgiving. Please forgive my mispronunciation of the German. He wrote in the mornings when the light was good on rag paper thick enough that he could scrape off mistakes with a knife. His handwriting was notoriously chaotic. He couldn't draw a set of parallel lines if his life depended on it. The maestro is said to have used his pencil not only to write with, but also to feel the vibrations of his piano, pressing on one end of the wooden rod to the instrument while holding the other end between his teeth. He was by now profoundly deaf. In less than 2 years, he would be dead. Once he finished a composition, Beethoven would hand off the manuscript to a copyist who'd write it all out again, this time legibly. After Beethoven corrected any mistakes the copyist made, berating the man the whole time, the score would go to a publishing house, where, after more last-minute changes from the composer, an engraver would trace it backwards onto a copper sheet. From there, the score would be published and republished, appearing in largely the same form on music stands across the world, even to this day. But even discounting those final revisions, the Opus 132 that the world came to know was not exactly the Opus 132 that Beethoven handed to his copyist. The composer littered his original score with unusual markings that the copyist simply ignored. Below one staff, for example, Beethoven jotted FFMO, a tag that wasn't a standard part of music notation and wasn't used by any other major composer. In another place, he drew an odd shape, like an elongated diamond, also a non-standard notation. None of these marks made it into even the first clean copy, let alone the published version. Almost no one would see those marks in the roughly 200 years after Beethoven first scribbled them down. Then one evening, in 2013, the violinist Nicholas Kitchen was in New Mexico coaching a quartet through Opus 132. Kitchen is a man of obsessions. One of them is playing from a composer's original handwritten manuscripts rather than printed music, so he had a facsimile edition on hand. The errant FFMO caught the eye of the quartet's cellist. "What's this?" she asked. As soon as Kitchen saw Beethoven's mark, something in his brain shifted. Later he would tell people that it was as if someone had turned over a deck of cards to reveal the hidden faces behind the plain backs. Suddenly, he had a new obsession. Over the next several years, he would come to believe he had discovered Beethoven's secret code. For most of the past two centuries, Beethoven's original handwritten manuscripts have been difficult, if not impossible, for musicians to access. Few could afford a trip to view them at the archives in Vienna or Berlin, and facsimile editions were prohibitively expensive. Scholars hadn't bothered taking a look. By the time musicology arose as a discipline, Beethoven was seen as passé, says Lewis Lockwood, a Harvard professor emeritus and co-director of the Boston University Center for Beethoven Research. "There is no army of Beethoven scholars," Lockwood told me. "It's a tiny field, terra incognita." Kitchen is not a scholar. A boyish 57-year-old with a shock of bushy white hair, he's a working musician and a faculty member at New England Conservatory, where my parents also taught. The Boston classical music world is a small one. Almost everyone I interviewed for this story is friendly with my violinist's mother and pianist father, and Kitchen is well known and well respected in those circles. Prior to reporting this story, I'd heard him perform with his quartet many times, although I didn't know him personally. That said, I was aware that Kitchen had a bit of a reputation as, if not an eccentric, at least an enthusiastic innovator. Around 2007, he persuaded the ensemble he co-founded, the Borromeo Quartet, to play from full scores instead of parts, because he felt it enriched the performance. A full score doesn't fit on a music stand, so the group was among the first to play from laptops and later iPads in performance. Around the same time, scans of Beethoven manuscripts began to appear on a wiki site for musicians called the International Music Score Library Project. The only thing better than playing from a full score, Kitchen believed, was playing from a handwritten original full score, the closest glimpse possible of the composer's working mind. Just by reading the manuscript, you are instantly exposed to an archaeology of ideas, Kitchen told me. You're tracing what was crossed out, an option tried and not used, one tried and refused, then brought back, all these processes that are instantly visible. The more Kitchen played directly from Beethoven's chaotic handwriting, the more anomalous notations he found. Initially, Kitchen didn't know what to make of them. My first thought was, well, it might be the equivalent of a doodle, he said. But once he began to study Beethoven's scores more systematically, he realized just how prevalent and how consistent many of these strange markings were across the composer's 25 years of work. Kitchen began to develop a theory about what he was seeing. The marks mostly seemed to concern intensity. Some appeared to indicate extra forcefulness. Beethoven used the standard F and FF for forte, loud, and fortissimo, very loud, but also sometimes wrote FFMO or FFF. He occasionally underlined the standard P or PP for piano and pianissimo, soft and very soft, as if emphasizing them. Kitchen would eventually identify 23 degrees of dynamics and counting from FFF thunderous to a whisper. He found four kinds of staccato, two kinds of dynamic swells, marks to indicate different ways of grouping notes together, marks to reinforce crescendos and diminuendos. Taken together, Kitchen argued, these marks account to living instructions from one virtuoso performer to another, an elaborate hidden language conveying new levels of expression and thus emotion in Beethoven's music that had been lost for centuries. Whenever people have tried to invent a way of writing music down, the solution has been imperfect. Jewish, Vedic, Buddhist, and Christian traditions all search for ways to keep sacred melodies from mutating over time. Each ended up inventing a set of symbols for different musical phrases, which worked as long as you already knew all the phrases. Other cultures evolved away from notation. In classical Indian music, for example, every soloist's performance is meant to be improvised and unrepeatable. In Europe, however, musical values began to emphasize not spontaneity, but polyphony, ever more complex harmony and counterpoint performed by ever larger ensembles. For these ensembles to play together, they needed some kind of visual graph to coordinate who plays what when. The result evolved into the notation system in global use today, an extraordinarily lossless information compression technology unique in its capacity to precisely record even music that has never been played, only imagined. Orchestras in Beethoven's time, as well as now, needed only the score to play something remarkably similar to what the composer heard in their mind. It's as close as humans have come, perhaps, to telepathy. By Beethoven's time, composers had developed ways to communicate it not just pitch, duration, and tempo, but the emotion they wanted their music to evoke. Dynamic markings shaped like hairpins indicated when the music should swell and when it should ebb. A corpus of Italian words such as andante, dolce, and vivace became technical terms to guide the musician's performance. The effect was a lot like the old religious systems. If you already knew how andante was supposed to sound, then you knew how to play something marked andante. But compared with the rest of the notation system, such descriptions are subjective. How passionate is appassionato, exactly? Someone like Beethoven, a man of extreme moods, might very well have chafed against these restraints. It's not a stretch to conclude, as Kitchen has, that Beethoven would feel the need to invent a method of more perfectly conveying how he intended his music to be played. But whether Kitchen is correct remains up for debate. Jonathan Delmar, a Beethoven scholar who has worked extensively with the composer in manuscripts, told me in an email that any anomalous marks in Beethoven's manuscripts were merely cosmetic variants, standard notations. Beethoven was a stickler for precision. Delmar explained, especially when it came to his music, and if he'd cared about these marks, he would have made sure they appeared in the published versions. I am absolutely convinced that indeed no difference of meaning was intended, Delmar wrote. Jeremy Yudkin, Lodkowitz director at the Center for Beethoven Studies, also initially viewed Kitchen with skepticism. When I first talked to him, I thought he was nuts, Yudkin told me. But Kitchen's close and careful research won him over. Yudkin now believes that Kitchen has discovered a previously unknown layer of meaning in Beethoven's manuscripts. There are gradations of expression, a vast spectrum of expression that music scholars and performers ought to take into account, he said. As to why the marks never made it into the composer's printed scores, Yudkin thinks Beethoven may have accepted that his large personal vocabulary of symbols and abbreviations wouldn't be easily deciphered by others. Perhaps, Yudkin suggested, he included the marks in his manuscripts simply for his own satisfaction. You put things in a diary, Yudkin said, because it yields a mental satisfaction, an emotional satisfaction in being able to express what it is that you feel, and no one else has to see it. Over the past few years, Kitchen and the Borromeo Quartet have presented a series of Beethoven concerts prefaced by brief lectures on his findings. But other than that, and his presentations at BU, he hasn't spent much time sharing his ideas with the world. Instead, he's been preparing his own set of Beethoven scores that will include all the marks left out of earlier editions. He wants other musicians to be able to see them easily without needing to decipher Beethoven's scrawl. And then he said, people can argue about all these things as much as they want. As I was working on this story, I asked my father, the pianist, why he thought Western notation had developed to such specificity even before Beethoven's time. He told me he thought it was because of a change in composers' perspective. Where before they'd been composing anonymously for the church, as music came more secular, composers' names became more prominent. They started to think about how people would play their work after their deaths, he said. For Kitchen, that's precisely the point of studying Beethoven's markings. If written notation can encode music, he told me, music can encode human feelings. Therefore, written music can actually transplant a living emotion from one mind to another. It's not just telepathy. Music allows a sliver of immortality. At this point, Kitchen believes he knows the code well enough that he can hear it in music. Once at a concert in Hong Kong, he was listening to a performance of Beethoven's Piano Sonata No. 23 in F minor, Opus 57, the Appassionata. He noticed an unstable chord that seemed especially ominous and unsettling. the kind of quiet but emotionally powerful moment that Beethoven often noted with one of his bespoke abbreviations. I said, "I bet you that's a two-line pianissimo," Kitchen recalled. After the performance, he checked. Sure enough, scrawled below the disconcerting bass note troubling the otherwise serene chord, Beethoven had written a double underlined PP. 200 years later, maybe, Kitchen finally understood exactly what that meant. That's all for today, and I hope you enjoyed this as much as I enjoyed finding good news out there. This is Angela Glosser from Sun Sounds, Arizona. See you next time.